funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role does the built environment play in the generation of greenhouse gases that play into climate change? And what role can the building industry play in solving the problem? While we tend to focus a great deal of attention on all the energy used for transportation, the U.S. Energy Information Administration says that buildings actually account for nearly 48% of all the power we use in this country, including three-fourths of all the national electricity supply. So as my guest today will tell us, architects have a vital role in helping us construct new, more efficient buildings and to sustainably renovate older structures we decide are worth keeping. Tom Powell is an architect with Good, Fulton & Farrell and the Texas Society of Architects Director for AIA Dallas. Ed Mazria, also an architect, is founder and CEO of Architecture 2030. AIA Dallas is hosting a sold-out event this evening with Ed Mazria at HKS headquarters in downtown Dallas. Tom and Ed, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
All right, let's start with this, Ed. What is the 2030 challenge?
Well, the 2030 challenge is a measured reduction strategy to address the fossil fuel energy consumption and greenhouse gas emissions in the building sector. And it started in 2006 when we issued it as a 50% reduction below the regional average for a building type, which was very high because we have a lot of old buildings in the mix. And it gradually gets to zero by 2030.
What does it mean for a building to be carbon neutral, Tom?
Well, that's a challenge, and it's a challenge for our building owners. But the whole point is that we need to get to the point where we're actually producing energy at the building location, and then that way we can begin to look at getting a carbon neutral strategy. Some of it's efficiency, some of it's getting green power off of the grid, and then another part of it is actually producing energy at the building.
So people in architecture and people in the building industry are aware of the energy consumption of buildings, but why is it that you think the general public, we get very hung up on our cars and airplanes, which are important and sources of greenhouse gas emissions, but why do we sort of give a pass to our homes and offices?
Well, because you're in an automobile, it's moving, you see a lot of automobiles. Buildings are sort of stationary. They're kind of taken for granted.
Yeah.
But they're there. If you look around, they're everywhere. And we spend about 90% of our time in buildings. So while we might be driving around for an hour or two, maybe getting stuck in traffic, getting a little frustrated, the building that we just left and the building that we're going to are all running 24/7.
And I think another part of that is, too, we probably purchase automobiles more often than we purchase buildings or find a building. So it's a long-term process, and we really haven't been trained to think that long in terms of the energy use of that building.
How important is it to think about the turnover rate of buildings? I was surprised to read that 75% of the built environment within 30 years will either be new within the past 30 years or renovated. That's a huge amount of home and office stock.
Well, that's the opportunity, really, when you look at it, because the turnover is quite rapid. In 20 years, between 20 to 2030 years, we essentially rebuild the environment every cycle. And so it presents a huge opportunity for us to really get this energy situation under control.
And part of that, too, is we build buildings that are really meant to last 30 years. There are some building types that are meant to last longer than that, but most of what we build in this country are 30-year type buildings.
Mm-hmm. So most people, there may be people listening who have business buildings and office buildings that they are in charge of or that they might build, but most people are going to engage with this issue in terms of where they live and the decisions they make there. And it seems like there are some sort of adages that may or may not be true, one of which is that the older a house is, the better it must be constructed because we just did things better the old way. And I'm curious about I see you both sort of grinning at this, your perspective on this.
I think there's some truth to that, but however, the part of the house that's really changed the most and the technology that's changed the most over time is glass. So where you might have a very solid wall, you leak through your glass. And so the newer houses and the newer buildings that have updated or more refined glass systems will have that advantage.
That's one of the answers. The other is that you're probably talking mostly about structural issues, that the older buildings are probably masonry and heavier and don't respond to climatic changes as quickly as some of the lighter buildings that we build today. But on the other hand, we have better sealants, better materials, better glazings. So it's a kind of a trade-off. The newer buildings are a lot more efficient than the older buildings is what we find.
So we have made progress in terms of, like, there are far better HVAC systems, right, and people are lighting their homes in different ways than they did even a decade ago. On the other hand, for a long time there, we kept asking for larger and larger residential areas, homes.
That's kind of leveled out. So that we've kind of reached almost reached a peak in terms of size. I think we actually were getting a bit smaller in a number of years. The projections are, I think, that we'll go back to kind of where we are. But with any building size, you should be able to get very close to zero net energy or zero carbon, depending upon how you design it.
So how do you get a building to make its own energy? Solar panels are probably the first thing that come to mind for most people.
There are two ways. Mm-hmm. There are two steps to get to zero. The first step is always what we say is design, and that gets you the largest reduction. So that's everything from where you locate a building, how you orient the building, what shape the building's in, what color the building is, where you put the glazing, what type of materials, the list goes on and on and on. Those are what we call the no-cost, low-cost options because it's basically information.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you get it down as far as you can, which is usually about a 70, even 80% reduction, then the other 20% becomes very feasible to do with renewable systems. And so you put on photovoltaic systems, solar hot water. There's all sorts of technologies and new technologies that are coming out.
And wind turbines. Wind turbines are really practical in our area.
Actually, on the property that you're constructing, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
And how do those look compared to the ones that we've seen as we drive out in the country? Are they smaller?
Well, they're much smaller in scale, obviously, mm-hmm. Yeah. And so,
they're kind of like sculptures.
Yeah, it becomes very sculptural and dynamic kind of visual.
So am I safe to assume that most architects are on board with this idea, that this is something that most people in your profession would love to adopt?
Well, we issued the targets in 2006,
mm-hmm.
and the American Institute of Architects immediately adopted it. So did the U.S. Conference of Mayors, a whole bunch of organizations. And the latest study that just came out, about 52% of all architects in the U.S., have adopted the targets. So we're now over the 50% mark. That's huge because we have a few hundred thousand architects. The AIA has 80,000 members. So that's quite a big number. So we're over the hump, so to say.
Yeah. In fact, the discussion amongst AIA architects is, sustainability has really become mainstream. Do we need to really highlight differences for a sustainable building versus a non-sustainable building? It's really become a mainstream design component.
So is there pushback at all from clients, or are they just as excited about this?
I get that question all the time in lectures. I have a bad client. I say there's no such thing as a bad client. When did a client ever come to you, put his arm around you and say, look, I want you to cost me more money every month in energy bills.
Mm-hmm.
So we, as architects, we literally make thousands of decisions almost instantly. It's very, very quick. We have to decide on all the material. You look in this room here, there's lights, there's wall surfaces, there's wall base, there's structure, there's carpet. I mean, there's literally thousands of materials that go into a building. We decide on all of those. The client doesn't tell us, oh, I want, he's not looking at every one of these things. So in essence, we have a huge amount of design freedom to make buildings incredibly incredibly efficient, and it's a plus for the client. So it's a question I get a lot, but it's a question that we answer quite effectively.
And you know, the two-part answer to that is for the first 50 to 70% that Ed was talking about in terms of building efficiency, that's a no-brainer. That's easy. Clients want that.
Mm-hmm.
Their only hang up at this point is, does it make sense from a cost standpoint, and they all have their own cost models, to go that next step and actually generate power from their building? And that's the only place where we have any concerns from the client side.
Is it standard practice right now to, in the initial design phases, create some kind of computer model that will estimate how much it will cost to run this building?
There are a number of companies that are doing that, and we use some kind of sketch kind of software, and so there's a number of plugins that are going right into that initial sketching model, so that you can really analyze what you're doing from a energy standpoint right away. And those things are really helping the practice.
Initially, the models were slow. So you'd make a whole bunch of decisions. And you're making decisions, again, instantly when you're designing a building and designing the form of a building. But you would have to make all these decisions and then plug the model in and then get a graph or feedback. And that would sometimes take hours. And so in the old days, it used to take days. Well, modeling obviously is becoming a lot more sophisticated. So now we've been asking for real-time feedback. So if we even, you know, nudge the building a little bit this way, what does that do to the energy consumption pattern of the building? Or if I move some glass from here to here, or if I make the glass a little bigger, or if I use this material rather than this material, we want instant feedback. Those models, we have one or two now that are almost on the market. One is on the market. And a whole bunch, I think, are coming to follow. That will essentially revolutionize how we design.
It's also a great argument for why kids really need to pay attention in math class. You know, they're always saying, how will I use this in my real job? You can have a cool architecture job and need a lot of math.
You know what I always say when I'm in front of architects? I say, architects are like kids. They don't want to look at these numbers and all that. So just tell us whether we're doing okay or not. So it becomes like a computer game, right? Mm-hmm. I'm doing this. I'm in the red. Uh-oh, bad decision. Let me move it back. This. Oh, good decision's in the green. So that's kind of the way we talk about it.
So there are, obviously, when a building is built from the ground up, you have to have an architect. When you're renovating, sometimes you call in an architect and sometimes you have a contractor. And I'm wondering if there's buy-in from contractors and people who may do renovations that are sort of below the level that an architect would need to be involved.
You know, the city of Dallas is really going full force in making sure that the code, and they've been an early adopter for the International Green Construction Code, responds to that, so that regardless of who's actually doing the work or leading the work, that it's still meeting certain thresholds for green construction. And that's been a big thing for the city of Dallas and for North Texas.
We are speaking this hour with Tom Powell, an architect with Good, Fulton, and Farrell, and Texas Society of Architects Director for AIA Dallas. Ed Masria is here as well. He's founder and CEO of Architecture 2030. AIA Dallas is hosting an evening with Ed Masria today at HKS headquarters. That event is sold out, but you can listen and learn now. And if you've got a question, you can interact with us because you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about Architecture 2030, an initiative to make all buildings in the United States carbon neutral by the year 2030, with Ed Masria, who is founder and CEO of the organization that bears that name, Architecture 2030, and Tom Powell, who is an architect for Good, Fulton & Farrell, and Texas Society of Architects director for AIA Dallas. That organization is hosting an evening with Ed Masria this afternoon. If you would like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Tom, you mentioned earlier that the city of Dallas, and I'm sure there are others in North Texas that have adopted codes that help to ensure that people are remodeling in responsible ways and using technologies that we know are good for the environment. There have been some other really interesting suggestions with, for example, making lower mortgage rates available to people who are making sustainable choices. Can you talk about those, Ed?
Sure. When a home is appraised, that determines your borrowing capacity in terms of how much you can borrow and how much you can afford. Normally, energy costs are not taken into consideration. There's a federal bill now that's kind of working its way through Congress. It's very bipartisan. Everyone likes it. Just hadn't gotten through Congress yet. It's called the SAVE Act, and it essentially mandates that that the value of energy be looked at when establishing appraisals. So when I think that happens, and I think a lot of many lenders now are becoming pretty savvy about energy consumption and looking at that as one of the benchmarks in terms of lending, when they're establishing how much they're going to lend.
And that's something commercial appraisals already do. They already take into consideration that. So it's really bridging that gap between the way they appraise commercial property and the way they appraise residential property.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Sybil in Dallas. Hello, Sybil.
Yes, hi, Chris. Thank you for always your informative programming. I find myself a homeowner having a 1952-built single-family residence, and I wonder with your guest expertise and your great skill as a questioner if they could share some tips about the best things that I can do to make my home more habitable, sustainable, and energy efficient.
Well, Sybil, my home's the same age, so I will listen just as carefully as you do to the answer. Thanks for your call.
Well, the 1950s era buildings, particularly around here, are when they would build solid structures, but it was before there was really the innovations in the glass and the glazing and those kinds of sealants and thermal and envelope materials. So, you know, there's a number of different tools that you can use to kind of check thermally to see where your house is leaking. And typically what you'll find is it's around your windows. So those are the first things you want to look at. And if you can get new insulated glass windows for your home, that's probably your biggest bang for the buck in terms of retrofitting that style house.
Mm-hmm. Second thing is insulation. Obviously, you want to check. During that era, buildings were fairly light on insulation. So you want to look at your walls and in your attic space. Ceilings, make sure they're really well insulated. That'll bring your costs way down, a very cost-effective opportunity.
Is there, I suppose it depends on the structure a little bit, but there are all kinds of choices for insulation, right? There's like radiant barriers, and there are fiberglass things that can be pumped in, and there's all kinds of equipment that comes, and sometimes it's difficult for consumers to know which sales pitch to believe. Any guidance there?
I'm a big fan of Rockwool insulation. It does have a tendency to settle, but it does give a good thermal value.
Mm-hmm. And it also depends on the building. Sometimes, you know, if you're doing a major renovation, you're tearing out walls, then you can do very high-end insulation. It's just very easy, and then you have a lot of options. If you're not tearing out walls and you just need to blow in insulation, things like that, then your options are a lot more limited.
How should decisions ideally be made in a world where buildings are built and their designers assume that they will last for 30 years, but in practice they may be functioning much longer than that. How should decisions be made about what gets torn down and replaced with something more efficient, recognizing that there's an environmental cost to tearing down a house or an office building and putting another one up in its place?
We just completed a study which illustrates that 48% that you talked about initially. About 40 to 42% is building operations on an annual basis, and then roughly 6%, 5% is all the materials that need to be made for construction and building a building. So that part on an annual basis is very small. However, in a new building, it takes about 18 years in a residential building to make up the amount of energy that went into making the materials and building the building in terms of operating the building. Mm-hmm. So on a new building, how you build that building is really very, very important. So architects now are beginning to pay attention to what we call the embodied energy or embodied carbon of a material. And we're asking manufacturers to give us a life cycle assessment and a number, standard number, for that particular material so that we can then we have thousands of choices for every material. So like wall base, we have, you know, I don't know, 1,000 companies for gypboard, for concrete. So now we want that number so that we can see which companies, you know, we want to specify and which companies we want to stay away from. Once architects begin specifying one company over another company, all the other companies then have to meet the standard of that one company. So that with the power of the pen, with the stroke of a pen, we can change entire industries.
Without in this country, passing legislation.
Without doing any, just through the I believe that architects don't really have a great grasp on the power that they control through the pen, or now it's the mouse, but it used to be the pen.
And one of the examples of that is the Healthy Product Declarations. That's something that's coming from architects pushing manufacturers to declare what they have in their materials, the health value of it. Similar to the FDA has mandated on food products for years. So last summer, the AIA here in Dallas had an event, the North Texas Sustainable Showcase, which featured healthy product declarations and companies that had those, and we're really promoting that and promoting that type of awareness by the manufacturers and the stewardship to actually step up and say, here's what's in our product.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Tim in Dallas. Hi, Tim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Every few years, DISD does bond packages for building new schools, and I went to some of the public hearings on those and advocated for DISD adopting LEED standards for the new construction, and got a lot of resistance at the meetings from the people, the DISD personnel, and the cities adopted LEED standards. And their claim was that it was just going to add too much expense and that they could probably get energy efficiency anyhow without the LEED certification. And I'm just wondering two things. If your guests have any insight into, does LEED really add that much? And two, do they perceive, if they are familiar with it, same kind of resistance from DISD as opposed to the city to these kinds of standards?
Thanks for your call, Tim. And as you answer, if you'd remind people who are not familiar with what LEED standards are, that would be helpful.
Yeah, the LEED standards is a U.S. Green Building Council Leadership in Energy Efficient Design. And DISD has come a long way from where they used to be, but they still have a long way to go. And they've actually done a couple of LEED certified schools. The Hector Garcia Middle School is a LEED certified school. And that took a lot of lobbying from the architects to get them to do that. And the rest of us were quite surprised that DISD did that, particularly because they had a way of dealing with design that was more based on how they were going to maintain a building. For example, they wanted to keep all of the glass in a building at quarter-inch glass so that they could replace broken windows really easily. Well, the thermal value of that was just awful. So they've come a long way, but they still got a long way to go. And yes, I do believe the caller's correct that the LEED standard is really a valuable thing. And one of the reasons for that is even with the city of Dallas's green code, which basically says if you're doing a LEED certifiable building, then you pass our code and you can build your building. But then to take it the step further and make sure that the commissioning is being done for that building, where someone's actually checking all of the systems to make sure that they're operating as they were designed and that the efficiency is being realized in the actual building.
This phrase might actually qualify as profanity in your profession, but portable buildings are surrounding so many schools these days. In terms of efficiency, sometimes we need them in the short term, but there are many campuses, not just in Dallas, but throughout North Texas, that have permanent portable buildings.
That's an issue that we're actually discussing at the state level. And Chris, that's something that you and I both know how it is in Dallas and how many of those portable buildings are around. And it really has become an embarrassment to the portable building manufacturers. They don't intend their buildings to be used in that manner. And when we approached them at a state level, that was their response. They really wanted to team with us to get that policy changed from really a state level. It's not just a DISD problem. It's really a statewide schools problem.
That's interesting that the portable building people think it makes them look bad if their buildings are used for years on end.
Yeah, absolutely. They're not designed for that, and they know that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Bill in Dallas. Hey, Bill.
Hello. I have a couple of questions that have to do with materials and labor. I would think that the way that a lot of materials are delivered to the site, like wood that isn't cured properly, which ends up shrinking, and also the labor pool, which doesn't know how to even make a right angle, would contribute to making it much more difficult to actually achieving the energy efficiency because the materials are going to shrink or just not be as tight as they should be. And where does the blame lie anyway for the materials being like that? Is it the manufacturers, or is it the builders, you know, not letting them cure? Who's at fault?
Well, oftentimes we really are reminded how much of an imperfect world we live in, especially when we see residential construction. Typically, what would happen, and even if the materials came to the site completely dry and in perfect condition, they're then exposed to the elements until they can get their thermal barrier put on. And inevitably, there's some rain activity that'll happen before that's able to be done. There are some systems out there where they're actually combating that by having the thermal barrier actually put on the wood sheathing so that when you're putting it up, it all gets closed at the same time. But yeah, that's something that it really takes a lot of diligence from the builder and the contractor to do any type of mitigation necessary to get the thermal moisture out of the building before they wrap it up. But with today's thermal enclosure materials, there's a lot of flexibility in those so that the imperfection of our lack of right angle world that we live in is less of an issue, but it's more of that timing issue. It's more of how do we actually close up the building while we're building it before we get that next rain event.
So clearly there are some standards that everybody wants to adhere to who is designing buildings and putting up buildings and renovating buildings. Not only are conditions different in like Tucson, Arizona and Portland, Maine, but within Texas we have a number of microclimates. And I wonder about the roles that local and regional architects are playing in sort of figuring out best practices, best strategies, best materials that really apply specifically only to one small area.
In terms of energy codes, that's across the board because you're really looking at a reduction target and localities built in because it's a reduction target below the regional average for a building type. So, for example, if you're in the Dallas area, you would have a regional average and you would be a percentage below that. As the percentage gets greater, then the difference between regions gets really small because when you're 70% below a big number or a number that's slightly below that or even slightly below that, it washes out by the time you get down into that that level. And that's where we are now. We're down at the low levels. So I think the regional differences in terms of a bench, in terms of where you need to be, are pretty minor now. However, the local architects really do have a handle on local conditions and what's possible and what's not possible, what you need to look at rather than what you don't need to look at. In the Southwest, for example, we're dealing with dust storms, and we have really intense sunlight. And, you know, if you're on the East Coast, it's a whole different type of architecture and different type of vocabulary that you're looking at. So local architects play a really important role on what gets built and what the issues are.
And really the biggest difference is the difference between a northern climate and a southern climate. In the northern climate, you're going to be spending the majority of your energy heating your building. And in the southern climate, you're spending the majority of your energy cooling the building. And it makes a big difference in how you put your building together, where your moisture barriers are, and so on and so forth. But it also makes a big difference in how you model your energy consumption. And this is something that we talk about as a southern state, that most of the ASHRAE standards are really thought through more of the northern mindset than the southern mindset.
Are these ideas also penetrating, say, corporations that want to put, 100 convenience stores in different parts of the country? Because while housing styles seem to vary and be appropriate, very often any kind of chain business seems to have the exact same building. And maybe I just don't see something that you see, but it doesn't matter where you are in the country.
Well, and I think that is really the weakness to that kind of chain store mentality is it really should be more reflective of that climate.
All right. Well, we'll take a break now. My guests this hour are Ed Masria, who is founder and CEO of Architecture 2030, and Tom Powell is an architect with Good Fulton and Farrell and Texas Society of Architects director for AIA Dallas, which is hosting an evening with Ed Masria this afternoon. Unfortunately, that event is sold out. But if you'd like to ask a question, we have availability at 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org. Or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about making the nation's buildings carbon neutral. We have Ed Masria here, who is founder and CEO of Architecture 2030, and Tom Powell, an architect with Good Fulton and Farrell, who is also Texas Society of Architects director for AIA Dallas. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Let's go on the phone now to Ken in Fort Worth. Hello, Ken.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
What I was calling about, we've just recently moved to Fort Worth area from Atlanta, Georgia. And in Atlanta, we lived in a LEED certified community called Serenity. And I know that the real estate market has tanked and gone belly up, but we still lost money on our very carefully designed custom home. Is there a way to make green consciousness affordable?
Well, you are probably in really good company over the last 4 years of people who have lost money in their real estate investments. The real payback, if you will, for that kind of energy efficiency design is really in the long-term ownership of it. And once the market understands that, then it'll be easier to recoup your sales price when you're selling a property. But I think your particular case is really indicative of just how the whole economy has gone over the last few years.
Do you imagine that consumers shopping for a house will begin to sort of demand evidence that there is really energy efficient design in the building in a way that they haven't in the past?
Well, labeling is now becoming, it's starting to become almost standard in certain cities that buildings have to be labeled, just like Energy Star appliances. Mm-hmm. You see how much they're going to cost over a year. That's now infiltrating the building market, especially commercial buildings. But I expect that that's going to be the norm within a number of years.
And I think consumers in general are just so much more educated. We can look up stuff online now and get data so much more readily than ever before, that we know more about our house. We know more about what we want in a house. And as we learn the paybacks from certain decisions and certain aspects of that, that'll continue to increase.
Ed, obviously you want to reduce the amount of energy that all buildings are using, but you particularly, the organization Architecture 2030 takes particular aim at the coal industry. Can you talk about why?
Well, you know, coal emits more CO2 per unit of energy that's delivered than any other source. So you obviously, if you're going to get a handle on this CO2 emissions issue, you have to deal with the largest sources first and then move your way down. That's not to say there are many people working on what's called carbon capture and sequestration, CCS, technologies where you can actually take out the CO2 and other particulates and things out of burning coal and then some people turning it into a product, burying it. I mean, there's all sorts of things that are being looked at. However, at this point in time, we're up against the wall in terms of a time issue. And right now, those technologies appear to be far off into the future. So the good news is many of our coal plants are very old and need to be phased out. And so they're being replaced with right now, if you would have asked me in 2002-03 when we discovered the issue of 2005 when we issued the targets, whether we could ever have a moratorium on new coal plant construction. We actually have a market-based moratorium now on new power plant capacity in the U.S. We have enough capacity to handle all our energy needs from now in business as usual till about 2025, 2030, and if we make our building sector a little more efficient out into the foreseeable future. So in essence, as we phase out these plants, depending upon where they are, we may not even need to replace them. And that's reducing emissions in this country. It's a pretty interesting phenomena.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go to Phil in Segoville. Hello, Phil.
Your guest spoke of buildings lasting 30 years. I believe I live in a house that's 25 years old, and it's probably energy efficient. But are we training architects to build timeless structures, or are we just training them to draw? And I refer to the stadiums and public buildings that they build. This week, the Dallas News had an article of whether they were going to build a new Ranger Stadium or Globe Life Stadium. And you look in Atlanta, I think they're going to be in their third stadium, I'd say within 30 years. The one in Minnesota was being taken down. Even Candlestick Park, and you can go to College Station where they're going to tear down. The amount of energy it takes to make the cement to go into the concrete, is that being addressed?
Well, let me thank you so much for your call, Phil. I think we got your point, and I think our guests are ready to address it.
We like to think our buildings last 50 to 100 years, so we like to design them that way. But
so is it market forces that mean that somebody wants something new?
I think it's renovation. It's a change of occupancy, change of ownership. People need different types of things. So you see this. There's a renovation cycle, for example, in commercial buildings. That's, I think, every 7 years in retail. And so there are renovation cycles within building types. Now, that doesn't mean you tear the whole thing down. Some people some people gut, so they keep the entire structure and then build around it. But the gentleman is right. It is less energy intensive to keep at least the structure of a building and then add to it and build around it and infill than it is to wipe it out and build new. However, many of the older buildings, in certain time periods, were not built to the best standards. So, in essence, they're kind of the weak link, and they get taken down.
And most of his examples were stadiums, and you see that really being a market driven force. You know, can the owner get the skyboxes that he wants? Is he selling the tickets that he wants? Is he keeping up with the Joneses, if you will? And I think that's really a big part of it. I think from a standpoint of those stadiums themselves, they would continue to stand, and it's really a matter of if they serve that market.
It's clever use of language when you said keeping up with the Joneses in the stadium example. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have an email here from Amy, who says, I want to build a residence in the near future in Ellis County, having problems finding energy sources that allow me to go off the grid. Any suggestions? Windmill? Wind turbine?
Really a combination of things. Certainly geothermal is very good in this area. We're prime for wind, and we're prime for solar. What we've found, though, is the payback on wind is actually higher than the payback on solar. So, you've got to look at all those resources, but I think you can do it. There's a group up in Greenville, Texas, that are off the grid, and they're promoting what they're doing in order to do that.
I think you have a number of options. The first thing you want to do is get your efficiency as high as possible. That means get your base loads down, efficient appliances, really good insulation, correct orientation. We're in a hot climate here. You want cool roofs, so that your attics don't burn up. So you want to get the energy consumption, the load, way, way down. Then renewables become affordable. And there are companies now that will actually put the renewables on, and you will see a savings, but that they take part of the savings to pay off the, for example, the photovoltaic system or solar hot water. I think is a no-brainer. We should be doing that automatically because that system is fairly inexpensive and pays back very, 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 very quickly. So there are lots of ways to go about this.
We haven't talked about landscape architecture and the role that can play, but for example, people who have very large trees will report that, you know, they pay less for air conditioning than their neighbors do.
Yeah, I mean, good old-fashioned planning with your trees shading your house on the west and southwest sides. I mean, those types of things really do pay off.
And, you know, if you're letting air into your building, you need cool air, and you take it through a shaded area before it comes into the building, that temperature is going to be much, much lower than if you're taking it in on the sunny side, for example, where the temperature might be up in the hundreds. So there are a lot of very no-cost strategies to dealing with architectural issues.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Clayton in Lone Willow. Hi, Clayton.
Hi. Thanks, Chris, for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to say a big thank you to Ed for the inspiration from his first book, Passive Solar Energy. The very first house I built with that was here in North Texas, and it was 18,000 square feet, passively heated and cooled.
That was in the 70s.
The numbers I got out of that book. And thank you so much for what you've done with Architecture 2030. It's really made an impact in things that I can point to and talk to about with potential clients.
Thanks so much for your call. Any
thank
response?
You. No. That book came out in 79, so he used it quite a long time ago. But the sun hasn't changed position, and things are still in the environment, still relatively the way they were. So it's still applicable today.
Yeah, and we're doing an AIA 2030 series to really help educate a new generation of architects to those types of passive strategies.
How often do you have the flexibility to, say, site a building in a particular way? I mean, if you have a lot and you need to build a strip mall or something, there's only so many ways that you can turn the building around. I mean, are there more opportunities to do this than maybe average people would realize?
What the answer, and I get that question also. So the answer I give to that question is, if you had a site and a program, we need this amount of square footage, we need this amount of parking, so the site's fixed, the program is fixed, and you gave it to 100 architects, and you said come up with a design, you'd never get two designs the same; they'd all be different.
And that's absolutely true. The only time where you don't have any flexibility is if you're in a downtown urban site and you're building property line to property line. But then you've got the shading of the adjacent buildings to help you. So you still have the idea of how tall you want to go.
Is urban planning part of the Architecture 2030 strategies at all?
Urban planning is huge. We issued actually three challenges. So there's the initial 2030 challenge was for buildings. The second challenge was really for developments in cities, and that took into account urban planning. It was transportation, water, and energy. And then there was a third challenge for products, building products. So we issued three. Planning is huge, especially now in the world today where we're planning so many new cities. So, for example, China, by 2030, I think the statistic is they'll have 221 cities over a million people. All of Europe has 35. To give you an indication, they're literally throwing up cities, as we speak. So how we plan cities has a long-term impact on their consumption patterns and their emissions patterns and their sustainability. So planning has really moved to the forefront along with architecture and buildings as something we need to pay particular attention to.
And as a part of that, Dallas has now taken on the 2030 district. And so we're creating a 2030 district to help really look at that kind of 2030 challenge from a group of buildings rather than just an individual building.
Just to explain what 2030 districts, they started in Seattle, but now they're starting to catch on. So there's one in Pittsburgh, there's one in Los Angeles, there's one in Cleveland, and one in Denver just launched, and now Dallas and San Antonio. A district is a downtown, usually a downtown urban area, started in the private sector, where the developers and the building owners and property owners and managers get together along with their architect friends who design all their buildings, who they trust because they're entrusting them with a lot of money, actually. And they form a district. They invite the city in. They invite the utilities in. They invite engineers. They invite everybody else in. And they form a district. But the core membership in the district are the property owners. And they meet certain targets, the targets I just mentioned for developments in cities. So they meet transportation targets, water targets, energy targets voluntarily. And they form the district, and then they kind of compete with each other within the district. But the great thing about the 2030 districts is they have longevity. They keep going from administration to administration because they're privately led, and that's the beauty of the 2030 districts.
Ed Masria is an architect and founder and CEO of Architecture 2030. Tom Powell is an architect with Good Fulton and Farrell and Texas Society of Architects Director for AIA Dallas. Gentlemen, it's been wonderful to have you both here today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.